Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
I was in the company of Eric Cantona, and I became a total juvenile, blubbering, incoherent mess.
That's nice.
I literally had no idea what to say to the man. I think I asked him, like, so are you staying in? He was at a meet and greet thing in Dublin, and he had one the following night in Belfast. And I was like, are you staying in Dublin tonight? Are you going to Belfast? And he was like, no, I stay. And I went, cool.
Have a good night then, Mr. Cantona.
Hello, you're very welcome along to this week's episode of The Group.
I jumped out of my skin.
I'm sorry, because you were so, my eager hello.
No, I'm just not used to the headphone situation.
I know, it's a lot. We're still here in the other studio this week. The TV show is not on air again this week. But I am news correspondent Zara King, joined by my jumpy fellow news correspondent Richard Chambers.
Hey, I'm just getting back into it here now. I'm calming myself down.
And political correspondent Gavin Riley.
Hello. You haven't changed your surname yet. You're still Zara King. You're not Zara Kingmaker.
Oh.
Now that you've officially done so.
So we need to... How am I the Kingmaker, though?
Well, in that last week, we discussed the prospect of Holly Cairns potentially becoming the Social Democrats leader, partly off the back of the meteoric media cycle prompted by the group chat, of course. And now it has come to pass that as we record this, Holly Cairns is now... the leader of Social Democrats.
I can't believe that, like, within the 7 days of us having that conversation, it went from Holly Cairns hotly tipped to be the leader to Holly Cairns became leader to making first speech in the Dáil. I just think it's a quick turnaround. Like, normally there's leadership contests.
There was never going to be a real contest with it, but like, it is fairly quick order, in fairness, to get it done.
I think it's really quick. Yeah. Has there ever been a quicker succession like that?
The second Tory leadership succession of last year. Not the first one.
A few of those.
Maybe the second one, yeah.
Yeah, fair. Okay,
They've gotten good with practice.
That's what it is. So, sorry, just off topic, but I mean, how do you think she's doing so far on day one, Gav? Your political assessment of that?
here's the unprompted tangent already.
Yeah.
So on the day that we're recording this, she has already done her first slot in leaders' questions, that she was in the job 11 minutes and it was her turn to speak in the Dáil to challenge Leo Varadkar and stuff. And I thought that it was very telling that the first thing she chose to raise was, I, a 33-year-old woman from Cork, I'm of the generation where... basically loads of my counterparts are never going to own a home, that we're the first generation that's ever going to be poorer than our parents, that there's a housing disaster and it's all happened on Fine Gael's watch. And I think when you're setting out your stall with a blank canvas, I think it's a really interesting and probably very fertile ground to start out on, for that to be your kind of calling card, going, listen, I am of the same generation as the three of us in this room. She's had to emigrate because of an economic downturn. She represents an age cohort of people who are going to struggle to ever be able to own their own bricks and mortar. I think it was a really, really interesting and very fertile place to start out from.
To end the... I mean, obviously there's been a lot of coverage of Holly Cairns in the last week, naturally enough, but she is still on a party which is... most often lumped in with others when you see opinion polls, because it doesn't register with people. Maybe she'll make a difference to that. I think she has a lot of problems on her plate with the Social Democrats, which, you know, it might feel like it's a good story. We've a young party and a young party leader. There's a bit of energy about it. They're not going anywhere yet. There's questions about whether or not they should merge in with Labour to become, you know, you're sticking two absolutely irrelevant parties together in the hope of making a slightly more relevant party. Maybe that'll work. There's internal questions about, you know, some issues within the party which need to be addressed in terms of organisation and stuff like that. And if there doesn't seem to be a quick change in terms of the party's prospects, well, then you'll be questioning in a while and be like, what was the point of all that?
Yeah, there is one takeaway point to close all of this, which is that a lot of new startup parties don't survive their second leader. That they often survive with the first one, and then the first one will leave because they either move on or they just want to stand down and let the next generation come or whatever. But then the second generation of people are often the ones who are not able to carry the torch forward. So No pressure.
Do you know what I kind of thought, actually, just when we talk about the quick turnaround, and like I know you were saying there really wasn't much contest there for the leadership, but they would have probably got a more of a run of like media appearances and a bit more media attention had they ran some sort of a
maybe
a but debate they, or back the, and forth.
Yeah, well, it may have done, but like
I think
it's
they missed
also,
a little bit. They missed out on a bit of coverage, probably.
But it's a relatively small party.
What do you think?
You can question whether it would have been worth having six TDs and 20 councillors publicly split. Over,
yeah, come on,
that's
not even a classroom's
right,
worth.
Enough, okay.
And like, I mean, in fairness, they did get a lot of coverage over the weekend. There's a lot of profile pieces about Holly Kearns, who has, of course, an interesting background, an interesting story, which isn't like most other politicians in the Dáil. So they couldn't have bought the level of coverage that they actually got in terms of the bang for the buck, in terms of the size of the party for the level of coverage that they've gotten.
True.
And that's been something which is actually probably is true, I would say, generally of the Social Democrats over the last number of years, is that they do get a lot of coverage. They do get. Whether it's because of Catherine Murphy and Roisin Shortall, they do get themselves in front of the microphones a lot in comparison to parties of similar size and some even bigger.
Well, we'll see how it plays out. Mm. It'll be an interesting couple of weeks and we'll definitely look back in it again. So starting off today, I suppose, look, technically the anniversary of COVID actually doesn't have a date because it was the 29th of February was the first confirmed case in Ireland. Today is the 1st of March, so I guess it sort of straddles
sort
between
the anniversary,
yesterday and today. But in the last couple of days, one of the former NPHET members, Professor Martin Cormacan, has been out speaking a little bit about the measures that were put in place, and he talks about the fact that he felt that some of the COVID-19 measures depended too much on fear and that some of them were excessive in terms of limiting people's basic freedoms. Now, this is not the first time that Professor Cormacan has spoken like this, and we can take a listen to this quick clip.
Key members of the HSE's management team talk with sincere regrets about the things that have been missed during the pandemic. Professor Martin Cormacan, the HSE's national lead on infection control, is pensive as he looks back on the first 18 months of the pandemic in Ireland. The one thing that stands out in my mind is the harm we've done to people that we didn't mean to do, he says. I don't mean any one person now, but I think that some people with good intentions probably took infection prevention and control in a way that I would have never thought about it. Meaning well did great and unnecessary harm by taking things too far. I ask if this is a reference to end-of-life visits, to partners who have been locked out of crucial appointments with their loved one and child in maternity hospitals. A number of things, he says, a number of things. You know more than I that things were brought to our attention where we said, we never said that. We never wanted our guidance to be interpreted in that way. That's not what we meant. He is commiserative about this. He makes sure that I do not interpret his words to mean that anyone was doing it out of malice. The people who have made these mistakes, it's not that they were bad people. They were frightened. They were often trying to do the right thing. But you know, I think that we, as a society, and as a healthcare system both, I think we could have been kinder.
So you might recognise that voice. Yeah. That is the voice, of course, of our fellow podcaster, Richard Chambers. And that is an extract from A State of Emergency, Richard's book documenting the COVID-19 pandemic in Ireland, which was released in late 2021. So a long time ago, you had that conversation with Martin Cormacan, and he's echoing those sentiments again now.
Yeah, and he has said them again since. I mean, it was a very high profile paper that he wrote where which has started this sort of focus on what he has said and what his views on things were. It's important to remember a couple of things about Martin Cormacan, who is a fascinating guy, really committed specialist in terms of what he does in terms of infection prevention and control. He was not on NPHET at the start of NPHET, which is probably something which is worth noting, because a lot of the decisions were taken early on in terms of things like closing schools, in terms of access to, you know, people going into the workplace and stuff like that, when he was not there. And there was an element of people believing that he was not let on NPHET in the first place because he would not have gone along with this, that there was a political element to things in a way. And this is something which is charged to Tony Houlihan a lot, is that he was quite political in terms of his selection and how he worked the room. Some people have described him, I've obviously reported this before, as being quite dictatorial in how he ran NPHET at the time. So Martin Cormacan was never really seen in that, despite the fact that he was the head of infection control and prevention, sorry, for the HSE, which seems like something you'd obviously want.
Kind of a glaring omission from NPHET at the time,
Big gap there. So what he has said here, and what he said in other things as well, including Pandemonium, the book by Jack Horgan-Jones and Hugh O'Connell, is that he doesn't believe that schools should have closed for the duration that they were closed for, amongst a number of other things which were done in the name of trying to stem the flow of the pandemic. That has obviously caused a lot of a stir because people are now seeing this as well. This is an admission of it, that there was a grave mistake there. But I think if you talked to other people on NPHET as well, they'd probably even say, maybe we didn't go far enough with things.
Well, this is the important point, I think, isn't it? Because part of why this has now garnered so much attention is that those who always thought the state was overreaching with the limits that it put on people's lives and the closures that it enforced, now kind of consider this to be, aha, well, proof. Like the lead infection control guy for the HSE says that none of this was warranted. And if he's talking about an over-reliance on fear, then doesn't that prove the point that the whole thing was a power grab? But in truth, it is one opinion, and it's a very qualified opinion and ought to be paid attention to, but that it doesn't necessarily mean that NPHET was, for want of a better way of putting it, doesn't mean NPHET was wrong. It just means that NPHET maybe could have had better advice. But it doesn't mean anyone in NPHET acted with malice or inappropriately. But it doesn't necessarily mean that he is right. It's just another opinion to throw into the mix, right?
Yeah, I think as well, you know, as you say, Richard, like in terms of the makeup of NPHET at the time, like I think it was very clear that, like, as you know, a lot of the members of NPHET were people that Tony Houlihan really trusted and worked with over the years. Like these were people that he really sort of rallied around in that time, and they were people who he had a very close relationship with. And that was really a very dominant, factor in people's position on NPHET at the time, particularly in the early days.
It sure was. And I mean, NPHET just grew over time, and it's actually been so
like
long
some were college
since
friends.
Even,
as, you know, some of the members of NPHET were college
friends. Yeah, people he started his career with and all that sort of stuff. And I can't believe we've mentioned the word NPHET so many times after almost going a long, long time without saying it at all.
We nearly made a point of going the first year of the podcast without ever discussing this topic again.
I feel like it's our life is flashing before our eyes again. But yeah, and I took another bit because I was having a look back on my notes from the book as well. That it's worth saying that Martin Cormacan isn't alone, I should say, in his view that he thinks things went too far in terms of preventing the spread of the virus. This is another senior member of NPHET, another senior member of the HSE, saying that effectively that the pursuit of preventing the spread of COVID-19 became a white whale, the Moby Dick, that effectively in pursuit of trying to shut down every avenue in which the virus could transmit, that they lost sight of secondary harm. And to quote this person, the captain of the ship lost sight. All he saw was the whale. There was enormous secondary harm. Ultimately, the cause was the virus, but there was secondary harm that will be with us for years to come. And he says he blames himself too for all of this, but this is something which is going to be looked at, whether that's in terms of, you know, missed cancer diagnoses. I remember speaking, I'm sure you did as well, speaking to GPs even locally about stuff like, you know, young girls and stuff like that who hadn't been in school, missing diagnoses of stuff which would have been picked up otherwise, even things like eating disorders and you know, more psychological things. Those sort of things were missed. And I think that is probably going to be something which is going to be focused on in this COVID inquiry, whenever that formally gets up, is basically what was missed. Why were the decisions taken that were taken? Was there enough oversight? Was there enough questioning of the direction that things were taken? I think you'll hear a lot of people push back on the idea of this, particularly people who were involved at the time, who were like, well, I don't want to go around seeing who blame of that. I don't think the politicians are going to look for a blame game.
No, and I think even in the clip we play there, Martin Cormacan, like, he's actually very clear in saying the decisions were made well in good intentions. And I think that that's probably at the crux of this. I mean, as you say, whether or not there was enough oversight and governance on the decisions will remain the outcome of that review will reveal that. But certainly, as journalists covering it and kind of witnessing it at the time, it was definitely, you know, certainly appeared that the decisions were made in good faith and that there was good intentions. But I think that argument about there being the whale, that white whale, and that one thing, I think that's probably a fair comment at the time.
It probably is. There's, of course, the secondary thing about the inadvertent harm that's caused. A, it's impossible on the day to quantify what that's going to look like. But B, you could also still argue that notwithstanding whatever inadvertent harm was caused, missed cancer diagnoses or any other illnesses that weren't picked up, you will never really know unless you could live in a parallel universe where you saw things go differently as to whether that is still the lesser situation. Like, what would have happened if, hypothetically, if some restrictions weren't put in place for a week after they were and the virus was allowed to seed more in the community? The damage that may have caused and the deaths that may have followed may have arguably, if it's possible to put metrics on these things, could have outweighed any secondary harm. The cancers that you may have picked up by keeping that operational for a week, the lives you may have saved there could potentially have been dramatically outweighed by the number of lives you could lose by allowing the virus to run.
Yeah, I think it's a hard one to actually to come to this realization, but I think it's probably fair to say that there is no real one right answer for anything which is taken, the decisions that are made. Every single country did something slightly different from every other country. Every health system, every company did things slightly differently to every other company or health system. Like, there was no one-size-fits-all approach that worked anywhere. Like, you've even seen in sort of the in the aftermath of things, the fact that we're even talking about still about, you know, COVID-19 situation in terms of China and how things have been spread there because of the zero policy there. There's been long-standing impacts in other parts of the world as well. It's worth saying that the whole point of why we were meant to be doing a COVID inquiry was meant to be to prepare for the next one.
The next pandemic,
I think that there is an element of where you do need to look back over what happened and whether or not, you know, there was enough care taken in decisions made. That's absolutely for everyone, particularly people who lost loved ones in nursing homes. I'm thinking of in that example, they will want to see that things were done with proper care and the proper procedures were followed. But the main thing, the main outcome which we're meant to be taking from any inquiry is to get ourselves ready for the next pandemic, because there's probably likely to be another pandemic within our lifetimes. That is often lost sight of in these things. And I suppose the fear among some people is, well, if you go around and you're looking for, well, X person did this and Y person did that, and these are civil servants, well, why would anybody ever stand up to these positions in the future?
I was just going to say, there's an element of it being kind of thankless, isn't there? You know what I mean? And you think of like some of the lesser known members in EFET that we would have spoken to and dealt with over the pandemic that maybe weren't necessarily the ones you saw on TV all the time. There were people who showed up to the meetings and, you know, came and you know, threw themselves into it with a heart and a half and probably did come with good intentions. And if they're the kind of people who are going to find themselves with the finger being pointed at them, those people may not step up again in the future. And that's a bit of a concern as well.
It has to be very policy driven. And for better or worse, a lot of how we ended up covering it for the 2 years that we were really in the thick of it ended up being very personality driven. Partly, I think, because of the circumstances about how COVID took root in the first place, and it was in that fallow period between a general election and a government being formed. So the outgoing government didn't really have the authority to do a huge amount unless Tony Houlihan was front and centre endorsing
it. And people were stuck at home, you have to remember, and like really worried about this. So like things like Tony Houlihan's evening press conference became the thing that everyone was watching, the number one most watched thing on TV at that time.
And that I think is the concern that we have to make sure that whenever there is any investigation, and Leo Varadkar only today, the day that we're recording this, has committed to there being some sort of, in his words, public inquiry at some point in this year, in 2023. But it really does have to focus and find fault maybe with the policies. But if it gets into a finger-pointing thing where you're talking about the individual people and you say Tony did wrong or Philip Nolan did wrong or Ronan Glynn did wrong or Stephen Donnelly did wrong, that's where you're going to get into all sorts of trouble, because you're not going to actually learn the lessons that you're supposed to learn for next time.
It is going to be interesting to see how this does pan out. I think one thing which, as an observer and somebody like the rest of us who was focusing in on, you know, how government reacted with, you know, how the public health officials reacted and how that whole thing intersected, I wonder how well the inquiry will work. It depends on how it's actually run. There's a question about whether or not things will be done in public as opposed to in private. I think,
and like the terms of reference and everything.
I think things should be done probably in public, because this was a thing which was, you know, governed absolutely everyone's lives for the best part of 2 to 3 years.
Like in a similar style to like an Oireachtas committee or something.
This is the problem. This is the point I was getting to, is like, given how I know you know and Gav knows about how politicians acted about any of this sort of stuff, can you imagine an Oireachtas committee doing this? And I don't mean this in any disrespect to people on Oireachtas committees, but there's an awful lot of grandstanding and there's an awful lot of, I don't actually want to get answers from this, I want to get my clip on the news. And I'm sorry, that's how things are run.
It is.
So I wonder about that, as to whether or not that is the best way we find fact or we find out how we take this forward so we don't make mistakes which were made in the past. And that's something as well, a lot of mistakes were absolutely made. I think that's something which we all have to acknowledge as parts of this, but it's going to be interesting to see what the actual makeup and how exactly you go about trying to account for what happened in the past, and look forward to how you prepare for the future.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
The Windsor Framework, formerly known as the Northern Ireland Protocol. Gav, what exactly is it?
I'm trying to think of a good example of a rebranding that actually kind of worked.
New Coke.
New Coke, Marathon becoming Snickers. Is it still the same thing?
What do you make of the name, by the way?
Very pointedly unionist. Yeah. You basically couldn't make the thing any more loyally British unless you had it wearing a Union Jack waistcoat and with a little bulldog sort of vibes going on. Like, it's the most ostentatiously British title you could give to it. So the Windsor Framework. Let's maybe rewind a bit, because to understand the Windsor Framework or why it is important or why it may finally bring an end to this whole saga, maybe we have to go a little bit back and sort of point out the problems with what it's replacing. And that's the famous Northern Ireland Protocol. Mm. So long story short, the Northern Ireland Protocol was a set of rules that were introduced when Britain actually left the EU as part of Brexit, such that Northern Ireland would remain part of the European single market, which was necessary to avoid there being any kind of a hard border on the island. But that in turn meant that a lot of British policy couldn't directly apply to Northern Ireland for fear of it creating the need for border checks. And it would mean that Northern Ireland was still under some supervision of European courts. And unionists in Northern Ireland naturally had some concern about this, because they're like, well, if the UK is leaving, how come we're being sort of left behind in this halfway house? The halfway house was attempted to be sold as a virtue, that you had the best of both worlds, but unionists thought they actually had possibly the lesser of both worlds. And that's their worldview, and fair enough. So Britain and the EU have spent the last 18 months or more trying to figure out some way that you can refine or ultimately replace this. And what they've come down on is effectively a replacement for the whole thing, which does still allow for Northern Ireland to remain part of the European single market. So anyone exporting from the north has access to the Republic and the rest of Europe. But when it comes to stuff that's coming from Britain into Northern Ireland, no longer will there be the need for any kind of checks to make sure that customs into the Republic are being dealt with. There are now two different lanes. There's a green lane where if it's stuff that's going to the north and staying there, there isn't any kind of supervision at all. And a red lane which will involve electronic declarations, but very little actual paperwork. So the intention is still to give them the best of both worlds. And the ultimate reason why we're talking about all of this is because they're hoping that the DUP will be so happy, that's the lead unionist party in the north, will find all of this acceptable and will agree to go back into power sharing, because they have pulled out of running a government in Northern Ireland for the last 18 months as a result of all of this.
And that's the interesting point about this, because this was the Northern Ireland Protocol, which was originally signed by Boris Johnson, which many people forget, not least of all himself. It did cause problems, and it did create an identity crisis for unionists in the north, because it effectively did create a border between Northern Ireland and Britain. Effectively, there was a sea border there, and it had an impact. A lot of businesses, even including Marks and Spencer's in particular, we'd be talking about sausages. Sausage wars was a phrase which has been used regularly. As much as actually, and I think it's something that which we have a natural inclination here to sort of poke fun and sort of almost downplay, I suppose, the concerns of unionists and, you know, the British side of things in, when it comes to Brexit, that we seem to, there's almost a natural thing. It's like, well, they signed up to it. Everything is tickety-boo. Everything's working well. For the most part, the protocol did work well. But for not everything. And there has been high-profile things which went wrong. But there was more about the identity thing. The green lanes and the red lanes thing is the way to fix it. But the DUP aren't on side yet.
No.
Which I think is actually, and I just want to say, because I listened to Sammy Wilson
At lunchtime today.
It was actually this morning I heard him on. I think he did an interview with The Telegraph in the UK. And he, because this was all, the pageantry around this is actually something worth thinking about. Whereas previously, British prime ministers, and we've seen too many of them over recent years, were almost seen as buffoonish, and everything was carried off with a bluster, and everything was like, "Well, I'm going to show Europe what to do," and all that sort of stuff. This was all very well done, right down to the fact that King Charles met with Ursula von der Leyen for tea at Windsor Palace.
Soft diplomacy.
Windsor Castle, isn't it? Windsor Castle, isn't it?
Yes.
Sorry,
yeah.
For von der Leyen's tea, if you want to put it that way. Sammy Wilson, annoyed, effectively. Effectively threatened King Charles.
A great line. That he's jeopardising the monarchy by getting involved in politics. That the king is insufficiently British, basically. Which is quite the take.
Insufficiently British.
That's basically what he's getting at. That he's not loyal enough to the UK and to its loyalists. That, like, what's he doing?
But here's the thing,
what's he doing getting all pally with Europe? He's one of us.
But here's the thing about, like, I mean, you can definitely see some DUP voters getting really sick of this, though, and like they just really want their lives to go back to some level of normality. Like, I mean, when it comes to like people's real priorities in Northern Ireland, I mean, it comes down to exactly the same as it is here, cost of living and just, you know, basically getting Stormont back up and running. Like, they don't really, you know, I think that there's a lot of people who are getting quite fed up of all of this.
Oh my God.
So
at the time of recording, we don't know whether the DUP will accept all of this as grounds to get back into power sharing in Northern Ireland. And that in itself is, it has a certain level of symbolism because we're obviously coming up to the 25th anniversary of Good Friday. We'd quite like the institutions created by Good Friday to actually be working at that point. There's also a good chance of Joe Biden coming over for a nice little shindig and a load of handshakes around Easter time if he reckons that there is something to go to. But he's not going to come if Stormont is in shutdown. But there's also probably a bigger question, and maybe this is a talk for another time because it could get so existential. But if the DUP won't go back in now, they're not going to stop Britain from doing this deal because Rishi Sunak is going to endorse this deal no matter what. It's going to get voted through in the House of Commons no matter what. It's going to become part of the new arrangements between the EU and the UK. And the EU has other stuff on its plate beyond just the affairs of Stormont. They want science funding and defence cooperation and security cooperation and educational collaborations. They want all of that taken care of as well, which this will help them do. But what happens if this deal is implemented and the DUP are still not happy to go back and share power with Sinn Féin and Stormont? Because then there's a big question really as to whether power sharing in the North is ever going to work.
I was going to say, is the DUP's issue more around the fact that Michelle O'Neill is First Minister? Like, is that the real, is it more to do with that, do you think, than...
Perspectively.
Yeah.
Is that really at the
crux of what's going on?
They've
here?
Never been totally unequivocal about saying that they're totally happy to go in and serve alongside Michelle O'Neill, even though it's worth bearing in mind that the roles of First Minister and Deputy First Minister, although there's a perceived hierarchy,
they're more or less,
they are the same role. You are co-First Minister. In fact, Sinn Féin, when Michelle O'Neill was deputy, they used to call her Joint First Minister because that's effectively what you are. So it's really only symbolism that you would be First and Deputy First. But yeah, if they don't go back in, you'd really question whether there's going to be any future and whether you have to go back to the drawing board and rethink how Northern Ireland is going to be run long term, because it's not going to work.
The word is that they probably will go in, that they're going to take a couple of weeks, perhaps even a month, if not longer, to have a think about all this. But they're going to have to quietly go along with this because they're not going to change it.
No. And I think it's the best available deal.
The rub of this for people is that there's a very strong chance, and I think this is probably the most important thing out of all this, is that we might not ever have to talk about Brexit to a huge degree ever again.
Fingers
after
crossed.
This.
Yeah.
Which is honestly
if the word Brexit makes you ill and makes your skin crawl, well, thank your lucky stars for this Windsor framework between the EU and Rishi Sunak's government, because it might well put an end to all of this conversation, all the consternation too around it. It could well all be over because of this. And as you were saying, Gav, they probably don't need the DUP to do this. The DUP, from what we understand, might, you know, they're saving face by effectively saying, well, we're not 100% sure about all this. Yeah. We have those, wasn't it, seven tests they came up with? The seven tests of the DUP?
So when they pulled out, like, they set down seven tests, which was that there would be no trading frontiers at all between the North and Britain, and that there would all these be political tests. And the Stormont break, as it's called, which will now allow MLAs the prospect of stopping European law from taking automatic effect in the North. Like, they're all things that work. But yeah, like, there's the seven tests. If the DUP says they're met, great, happy days.
It doesn't matter.
Brexit's then legitimately in the rearview mirror. Like, we can stop thinking about it. Mm. But will the DUP take it? I suspect they probably will have to, because they're not going to get anyone else to go back to the table and revise all of this again. So there may be some role for the European Court of Justice to oversee what happens inside the six counties, but they're going to have to swallow it, basically, because it's the best deal they're ever going to get, and they need this to be behind them some way or another.
It says a lot, doesn't it, about Rishi Sunak and even him as a personality, I would say, doesn't it, in terms of the relationship that he seems to have formed with Ursula von der Leyen.
Yeah.
There's a genuine kind of warmth between the two of those. And, like, you haven't seen that warmth between Britain and Europe for, like, a really long time.
There was no Dear Boris coming out of Ursula, but it's all Dear Rishi.
Yeah, yeah, I have to say.
I would say that's probably one of the most interesting things that's happened here, is that there was definitely a marked change of approach. If you went back even the last three prime ministers, so you went Truss, you went Theresa May, and you went Boris Johnson, that there was always this air of conflict about it. And I think that the biggest read that this is actually going to get the okay and this is going to be fine is that even the most ardent, the most stridently Brexity, gammony press in the United Kingdom has said, like, I know,
gammony.
I think it was the Mail.
Gammony.
The Mail said, has Rishi done the impossible? Rishi Sunak also has had a miserable start to his life as Prime Minister. This could be the turning point for all of that in terms of the relationship between Ireland, Britain, and the EU.
At least when Liz Truss was Prime Minister, you could get vegetables so you could measure whether people were still staying in office or not. Like under Rishi Sunak, you can't even get a lettuce in the supermarket to try and figure out whether you can outlast it or not.
But the most entertaining point of all of this was when Rishi Sunak the other day was in Antrim to sell this deal to unionists at a Coca-Cola factory in Antrim.
He's a Coke addict, is he? Or like a self-described
Coca-Cola addict.
Yes. Yeah, I think we might need to catch that on the edit.
you know what I mean? It's
yeah,
brand new.
Yeah, but he's a soda fan, if you want to put it that way. But
I don't even think he drinks or smokes. Soda is his kind of liquor of choice, isn't it?
Yeah. But he was there and he was trying to sell this to unionists and he was sort of saying, he's like, guys, you have the best thing possible. You have access to the UK market and the EU single market. This is the most incredible thing. This is now the most exciting economic zone
in the world,
which is an incredible descriptor. I don't know if you know any other economic zones which are terribly exciting, but that is it now. Northern Ireland is now set to become the most economic exciting zone in the world. But like, I mean,
because
what he was describing,
it still has what everyone else voted away.
Yeah, pretty much.
Like the thing about it as well, just going back to the Rishi Sunak point, like, is that it's given him a kind of a real statesman sort of vibe, in fairness, and it's also, as you say, it's the first time that Britain hasn't come across as being kind of, you know, argumentative, confrontational and aggressive. It seems like it's the friendliest Britain has appeared on the international stage in a long time.
But there's one material change that they've done, which has allowed this deal to actually happen in ways that it didn't previously. Because people who have been following this at certain arm's length will know over the last 3 or 4 years that unionists and Brexiteers have constantly talked about, why can't we have green lanes and red lines, and why can't we just operate in good faith, and why do we need to check all this stuff coming into the north, and surely there's technological solutions we can deploy. And usually they got sort of fobbed away or laughed out of the room as being pie in the sky stuff. But now that's what's happening. The reason why it's happening is because previously British government said, well, the EU wants to know what's going between Britain and Northern Ireland so as to safeguard their own market, which is just none of their business. That's going from the UK to the UK. So what do they need to know? It's nothing to do with them. And Rishi Sunak says, well, no, if in good faith you need to make sure that there isn't stuff coming across the border from the north into the Republic, we're going to share the paperwork filings with you. So if somebody says, here's what's going from Britain to Northern Ireland, we're going to share the records so you can see it. It's a level of pragmatism no one else did. But Rishi Sunak, by agreeing to share those records, has beaten down the path to a deal that no one else got.
Yeah. Do you know who's gutted about all this, Lara?
Who?
Boris Johnson.
I would say so.
Absolutely sickened. Because he was on manoeuvres over the last couple of days and he was trying to plant the idea in unionist heads that they should vote this down, they should just object to this, and there would be this rebellion over this deal and it would see him, you know, catapulted back into 10 Downing Street. Because he's been looking, he's still sniffing around. He's still looking. But imagine that level. There's something to be said, and I don't think it is really, like, you know, denigrating or jumping out of the impartiality of journalism to say, there's something incredibly strange and unsettling about the idea that you would try and just bin this idea of a deal to settle a long, long-standing issue between a trading bloc, a country, and our nearest neighbours. Just to try and get yourself back in the job of number 10.
His personal success.
Well, this is it, that he values his own power above the welfare of his country. Because
that's what this is
ultimately down to. So.
Okay, so, I mean, while we're on this now, maybe favourite or most predominant Boris Johnson memory in your time covering him, working on Brexit?
None. I don't. Like, I mean, this, it's a good question, but like, there's almost an element of like,
favourite's the wrong word, right?
Yeah.
We did not prepare for this, so we're all just sort of scratching our heads now. I remember I was in London when he became Prime Minister that time, and, you know, like, I think at the time he really, there was a wave of support for Boris Johnson at that time, but I mean, it was a rapid deterioration.
Yeah, my standout memory is when he came to government buildings to meet Leo Varadkar during his first tenure as Taoiseach. And he came out and he got out of the car and he basically looked like he'd been sleeping in a ditch. And like, he did not have his suit all straightened up. And I remember taking a photograph.
Literally, just
a snap to take for Twitter. Literally just to hold your camera open, take a photograph and just send it away. And the frame that I happened to get was basically of Boris Johnson with his hand basically down the back of his trousers trying to pull up his slacks. And like, it just, Leo Varadkar there, you know, well-fitted suit, you know, had made an effort, and Boris basically rolling out of the back of the taxi and pulling the slacks up from around his knees. It was, quite the contrast.
I remember when I was in, we were in New York for the UN week, and we were, a few of us Irish journalists were going to Duane Reade, as you do in New York, to pick up like toothpaste and bits from the pharmacy, effectively. Yeah. We were just outside the pharmacy. It must have been like 10 o'clock at night, and you just see Boris Johnson waltzing down the street. All right, Prime Minister. All right. And that was it. But also, actually, if you were to take a standout Boris Johnson, most Boris Johnson-y thing ever, that all of this dishevelled, shambolic stuff is all for an image to be relatable. And the thing is that he, even just today, he was pictured getting out of his car to finish off a run just for the cameras. Like, he didn't go
not,
for
not
a run.
The first time he's done that.
Yeah.
Stop.
Like, well, they're forever doing that. You know, in Britain, where they've got this culture of sticking cameras outside people's gaffs so that they can get them... when they, you know, they can look like they're doorstepping someone, like, oh, what's Jeremy Hunt think of all of this, and you go and doorstep them, and they're just coming in from a run. They're coming in from the run that started just around the corner.
Ah, here.
Like, yeah, he's let out, of the, let out of the Land Rover.
Oh, that's desperate. To, you can't be at that. That's desperate. Yeah.
I found the picture that I took of Leo Varadkar and Boris Johnson, and they... it's
he
quite, it's
does
quite
have
the double
his
act.
Hand down his trousers.
He literally does.
What year was that?
September 2019.
He's aged a lot since then, actually, hasn't he? Yeah.
We all have.
We all have. Okay, so listen, let's see how this plays out, I guess. We don't even know. We'll know by next
My
week.
My prediction is we'll never have to talk about Brexit on this podcast in a what's going to happen next sort of way ever again.
That is exciting.
Caveat to that, though, which is that Brexit influences everything that goes on afterwards.
The concept of it is going to be completely different. Yeah. In that we're not going to be talking about it.
So they got Brexit done then.
The same.
Finally got Brexit done. Hashtag got Brexit done.
Okay, so back home, SVP has a new report out today which is showing that almost 400,000 people say they were unable to heat their homes last year, and that is more than double the number in 2021. Now, I know we've had this conversation many times here on the podcast about cost of living and the energy crisis, but look, this report today just brings it back into focus, I suppose, and restarts the conversation. I was at the report launch this morning in Boswells, and there was a lot of the volunteers from SVP from all over Ireland came to the launch today, and it was actually really interesting. They had a town hall, kind of, for want of a better word, where they got to kind of give anecdotes and insights from their communities, you know. And there was one lady who was talking about a woman who came into her local SVP, and she was a mother of three kids, a single mum of three kids. And she's operating every week at a deficit of €74. Like, she's always short just over €70 a week in terms of everything she needs to pay her bills and her groceries. And
has she got savings, or where is it coming from?
No. So I'm not sure. I think she was looking for help, when she came looking for it. So, but the point that this lady was making is, like, you know, those €74 add up, and, like, you know, at the end of the month.
£300 a month.
Yeah, so it's a constant. So there's a constant debt there all the time. And just to hear those kind of key examples. Also, you know, talking about the impact that the energy crisis is having on people with disabilities as well, that they are disproportionately affected, and it's something actually we haven't talked about in much detail, but just that idea of, say, there was one man gave an example of a gentleman who had COPD and had to have a machine operating all day at home to help him literally function and breathe. And, like, the cost of running that on your electricity bill is through the roof, you know, and that man, because of his illness, unable to go out to work then as well. So it's just, I think it was just an interesting, you know, conversation back and forth today. Also, that conversation around debt collectors for those energy companies, and the SVP very clear today in urging those companies to lay off a little bit, in terms of, like, one woman talking about living in fear of answering the phone and feeling totally harassed by these energy companies. Now, like, there was a representative there from the energy companies this morning saying, look, the point would be answer the phone and we'll come up with a payment plan for you. But if you're operating on a €74 a week deficit, you know, payment plan is going to make no difference to you, because you actually
don't have the money to pay it anyway.
Yeah. Certainly not. It's actually interesting that you're having that sort of conversation at a time when politically now there's a bit of backlash at one of the main providers, Electric Ireland, over the fact that they are now reducing prices for business customers first before touching residential, as in people's homes, people who have been most affected throughout this cost of living crisis, this energy poverty crisis that we've gone through over the last winter. It's a tough one to stand over and defend, particularly with the profits that have been made by a lot of companies and energy providers and fossil fuel giants over the last year or so.
They're saying more people who are working as well are coming in asking for help. SVP have cited examples of people who would have previously been, like, big donors who would have donated to them, now coming back around saying, look, I'm sorry, I would have normally supported you, but I'm going to need your help now. Which is interesting. And a representative from Barnardo spoke this morning as well, saying that there's actually kind of, even without being disconnected, that there's this fear of disconnection, right? So the people are basically preempting a potential cutoff. So they're now going without maybe even unnecessarily to some degree, because they're just so anxious about the possibility, not totally unnecessarily, but yeah. as in they're saying that, you know, you have situations where there are parents so afraid of being cut off or so afraid of going into debt that they are preemptively sort of cutting essential things out of their life, particularly they're seeing children being affected, children being left without because the parents are afraid of going into debt. So look, it was just, I mean, I know we've talked about it many times and there's only so much we can really say on it, but I think that the report today from SVP just puts it in black and white there in print. You know, all the things that we've talked about are very clearly outlined in that report. The numbers have doubled in a 12-month period of people who cannot afford to heat their home.
Wow. On that note, actually, and it's funny that you mentioned a few energy related things there, particularly people who have vulnerable medical conditions who have to run kit, which drains a lot of energy. I have a bit of a bee in my bonnet about the windfall tax, because only this time last week we were talking about the government's cost of living package, and they said that's all we're doing now before you know, the budget in October or whenever it is, and we're going to keep some money aside so that we can make a difference in people's lives then. But they're also talking, on the other hand, about having a windfall tax possibly in place within weeks, so that when energy companies start reporting their profits for 2022, that the government immediately has a way of clawing back all the profits that they didn't expect to make. But if they're not going to do any more measures until October, they're going to be taking in hundreds of millions, if not billions, in windfall taxes and sitting on them and not giving them back to people in the middle of their rainiest days. Like, how do you justify to the woman who's running at a deficit of €74 per week? How do you tell her that, okay, yeah, you're paying huge amounts in energy bills and we've got the windfall tax and we're going to sort you out in October? Like, your rainy day is now. And I don't
her
know really
rainy
how,
day has been happening for weeks, for months.
So I don't know how a government's going to justify taking in all that money in windfall taxes but then sitting on it until a budget in October. I think they're going to find themselves having to do something else to give the money back sooner rather than later.
Gavin, why is everyone talking about Bertie Ahern?
I don't know.
Richard, why is everyone talking about Bertie Ahern?
You're going to be seeing a lot more of him too.
Bertie is back.
Bertie is back in a very public and visible way, and we're going to be seeing a ton load of him by the time we get to the anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. But the whole talk is he might run for president. This has long been mooted as a thing which could happen. But now he's out there, and I even heard him. He was on the News Agents podcast in the UK there, and he was sort of saying, oh, look, if I have something to tell you about it, I'll come in and I'll tell you guys here first. I'll get the exclusive on it. So, like,
Absolutely do not give Lewis Goodall the scoop. Yeah. Sorry. Now, like, Lewis is nice and he's been good enough to come on the podcast before, but don't make that your reveal, Bertie. Seriously.
Yeah, so he...
Revealing it to a British podcast that you want to be the Irish president is quite a bizarre...
It was all a bit of crack to Bertie in very Bertie ways, but... It was interesting that there was the poll out at the weekend, though, which showed that I think it was more than 50% of people would definitely not, was their term and phrase, vote for Bertie Ahern to become president. Which isn't necessarily, I mean, all you need is, like, if say 20% of people would definitely vote for him, then he'd be fancying his chances at that point.
I should say, by the way, that when I joked, I don't know why he's in the news, that was a joke.
No, I know, whether transmitted.
I do this for a living. I hope I know why he's around. That poll was fascinating, that Red
Nobody
Sea poll.
Nobody thought you didn't know, Gav. Yeah. Don't worry, love, it's fine.
Well, the reason why I joked and said I don't know is because the idea of him running for president is so harebrained that, like, it's never
is
going
it
to...
Though?
Yes.
It
really is.
Ara, look at now, and I tell you something, right? I never underestimate the political ambition of somebody like Bertie Ahern.
The first time,
never underestimate the desire for power.
No,
like, you can't.
Fine,
like,
but the first time that
you have to assume that all former leaders would want.
And as soon as he announces, and the first time he does any kind of a press event, he's going to face the questions that he's managed to avoid from the Irish press for the last 11 years, which is how come a tribunal of inquiry found that you accepted £165,000 in donations and couldn't account for where they came from. Like, that's a huge thing. It was never resolved, and it'll only come back, and people of our generation who didn't live through the tribunals and maybe the details of what he was alleged to have done or not done have been glossed over. But like, that's going to come back. That Red Sea poll was fascinating because it was asking people in a hypothetical two-way race between Bertie Ahern and Gerry Adams, who would they rather vote for? And 60% of people said, given those two candidates, they would not vote.
Really?
Yeah, and the 21.
Somebody's got to win, though.
Yeah, no, the presidential election is always mad dirty, though, isn't it?
Which is why
it's one of the dirtiest campaigns, and like almost to the point where it becomes like really uncomfortable. The level of stuff that's revealed about people, like, I actually find it filth. Like,
but that's,
the president's
that's why he's not
going to
run.
It's just the worst.
I don't know, Gav.
Who'd run for president?
Bertie Ahern, like, was Brian Lenehan's director of elections in 1990 when this whole thing about
every bit of dirty laundry out there on the line.
Doesn't
it's
matter.
Just filth.
Does Teflon? Teflon is the nickname which followed Bertie around for a long time. Because he doesn't really, it isn't going to unsettle him, the fact that we're going to have to talk about all the things we've talked about for a long time before.
It gets a bit personal though, doesn't it? Sometimes
it does. It's going to be the race for Áras an Uachtaráin is a knife fight.
It is
an absolute knife fight, politically speaking.
And Bertie Ahern has armed all of his opponents.
Yeah, but like, I mean, we all know that. It isn't going to stop him running. It might mean that a lot of people won't vote for him, but it's not going to stop him from running. Why else is he out here doing all these things?
Became a bit of a circus the last time, if I can remember, though. I mean, it feels like so long ago now, but like, I mean, geez, remember some of the candidates? It was all a bit...
It was Peter Casey and Sean Gallagher 2, and then before that it was Michael D. Higgins and Sean Gallagher 1, and Dana, and some of the drama that surrounded her campaign. And the time before that was Mary McAleese uncontested, but Dana wanted to run that time too. They always get
It just gets really dirty, really messy, and I don't even know, does the voter want that level of, like...
Which goes back to your question then as to why is Bertie back around, and the reason is that Fianna Fáil want to have somebody to be their ambassador for the victory lap of Good Friday 25 coming up next month, and as it stood, without Bertie Ahern being in the party fold, they had nobody to put forward to accept the flowers that everyone else is giving.
But it's not going to be enough to trade on, is it, Richard? Like, really?
It is the ultimate question on what Bertie Ahern's legacy is going to be. Is it going to be the tribunals, or is it going to be the Good Friday Agreement? And the gamble is being made by Bertie that he can make it so that we will all think about the Good Friday Agreement and somehow, I don't know how, look past the tribunals and look past the crash and everything that happened following his government. It's a hell of a gamble to make, but I do think when it comes down to it, he probably will run. I do think he probably will run. I don't know.
I agree. I think
he thinks he's going to run now. Whether or not he actually does in the end, I think he thinks he's going to run.
Are there some people, Gavin, do you think, that will remember Bertie Ahern for like the boom times, like that will remember the Celtic Tiger and think?
Yes.
Do you think like that they almost who could forget about the crash? I mean, no one's forgetting about the crash. But I'm just saying, like, are there some people who just associate Bertie? Like, I remember being in secondary school during the height of the boom, and Bertie Ahern's big, you know, big boom time, and I think people really.
Richard is giggling because I think he's just recalled the Monty Burns. Yes,
no, it's not actually that. Actually, no. I just find the general. Yeah,
tell the rest of the class now.
I think the collective amnesia which takes place within.
I find that very funny.
Is very funny, and I think it will be traded off. It will be traded off. There will be a feeling of, sure, didn't Bertie do this, that, the other?
Well, there will, because he wasn't around at the time of the crash, because he'd already handed over. Now, you could argue that all the damage was done and that all the regulatory decisions that led to the bank guarantee and then the bailout all happened under his watch, but he was lucky enough to be forced out by the tribunal in time to not be around for the bank guarantee.
I never thought I'd get to potentially report on a Bertie Ahern political campaign, and I don't think any of us ever thought we would, but here we all are, staring down the barrel of a presidential election and potentially him running.
Who else do you think is going to run? Are we playing that game?
I think Gerry Adams will run.
Yeah.
And the reason I think Gerry Adams will run is that the government, the successive Fine Gael governments have now promised for 7 or 8 years to have a referendum on extending the vote for presidential elections to Irish citizens living outside of the state, to Irish people living in the north and Irish people living abroad, who many of whom, if they've been there for long enough, have a very romanticised view of the Troubles and what they see as a fight for the independence and the return of the fourth green field. And I think any Sinn Féin candidate gets a little bit of a leg up, electorally speaking, in that event. So if that referendum on extending presidential voting rights does happen, I think Sinn Féin will think that Gerry Adams has a good chance of getting the office.
I don't know who else will. I think it's always a surprise. I think we would be better served, perhaps, in any future presidential election by it not being dominated by candidates from one reality television show.
That would be good.
We should just change reality show that they come from now. Can we just make them the judges from Home of the Year? Can we have like Hugh Wallace running against people going around the Oris going, it's perfect, I give it a 9.
And what about like the idea of a young person? Like, is Ireland ready for a young president, maybe?
Well, we voted against allowing very young presidents.
I know, yeah, obviously, yeah.
We're only just... In fact, is Richard yet old enough to run for president? Are
nope.
you 34?
Nope.
You 30? No. So Richard's not... The law is such an ass that Richard Chambers is not eligible to be our president.
Would you ever run for the presidency?
Absolutely not.
Would you not?
Politics is not my game.
Side note, I am really... This, by the way, not the idea of running for president, but just the fact that presidential candidates have to be age 35 is actually something that's... Not close to my heart is a weird phrase. But we had the referendum...
It is 35.
Yeah, so the referendum...
I'm not old enough either.
On the same day that we had the referendum on marriage equality, we had a referendum on lowering the age of presidential candidates so that you would be at least entitled to seek to run if you were 21 years old. And it got rejected because everyone was like, oh, you'll just have President Niall Horan or President Jedward. And people.
What would be wrong with President Jedward?
Both at the same time.
But well, the reason why that sticks
Jedward
in my mind.
Jedward has been speaking a lot of truth to power in recent years.
The reason why it sticks in my mind, the reason why it bothers me, is that I was the political correspondent in Today FM at the time, and because there was nobody arguing in favour of a yes vote that would actually go on air and have an argument about why this is necessary, an entire referendum passed that I could not cover. Because I couldn't find people to act out or argue both sides of the debate.
You need to pursue the balance.
I couldn't find a single advocate who would make the case for Labour. So it was the forgotten referendum. And of course, marriage equality will live much longer in people's minds. But the other referendum of the day was whether people of your age, Zara, and your age, Richard, should be allowed to even think about running for president. And your fellow citizens said no.
Well, had it passed, another man who could have potentially become president as one of Ireland's favourites is 27-year-old Paul Mescal.
Yes. Why shouldn't he be allowed to be president?
I mean, I feel like there will be.
He's got
huge,
good Gaeilge.
Absolutely. Paul Mescal found himself in a kind of a, I suppose, very upsetting situation, really, in a lot of ways, in the course of taking a selfie. Richard, do you want to maybe give us the insight into this one?
Yeah, he raised this story recently to Paul Mescal of how he was effectively groped while somebody asked for a selfie. A female fan asked for a selfie and effectively groped him while doing so. And he was very, very angered by this, absolutely naturally. And it sparked a bit of a conversation around, I suppose, access to celebrities, for want of a better word. The fact that selfie culture has got to this point where people feel that they can do this. It's effectively like there's no way around it. That's a horrible experience for that guy to go through. Very nice guy by all accounts, and it's really terrible that this happened while he was basically taking time out of his own life to do something for a fan, is what he thought was the situation. And it's very grim, and it is a sad reflection, I suppose, of the world we're in.
What I was going to say was, if this had happened to a female actor, like, it would be total outrage. Is there a double standard, do you think, when it happens?
No, because I do think the same outrage. I think there is still outrage.
Well,
there
is now. Maybe that he's called it out, though, because I mean, but there's some people who say, oh, he's overreacted. But you know, have you ever been in a situation where you felt maybe like somebody crossed a line with you, like that a woman had crossed a line with you?
In truth, no. But I think the overriding theme is that sometimes people think that famous people or other people that they just think are attractive or handsome or good looking, that they're there simply to decorate your world. And they are not. They are people too, who are entitled to not be groped just as anyone else who walks down the street.
Yeah.
And just because he was a heartthrob on normal people, or because he's very good in After Sun, or because he's going to the Oscars next week, is not an excuse for you to go fondling him. No.
Like, that could be a very traumatic thing that actually happened to him. I mean, I think that's something which can't be looked past. But also, just on the virtue or the general point around the whole selfie thing, who did I read during the week? I think it was Chris Pratt and a couple of other celebrities are like, we just don't do them anymore. We just don't do them anymore because the person isn't actually in the moment, but they're actually looking to steal a moment, just basically to commodify it later for, you know, kudos online or whatever like that,
as opposed to
I'm delighted to meet.
Yes, they don't want to meet you. They just want to have a record of having been in your company.
Yeah, exactly. And just generally, they feel that people are crossing the line a little bit too much these days.
But I think saying no sometimes is probably quite awkward for people as well, is it?
It's probably unwinnable, because if you become a celebrity who has a rep for never stopping for a selfie, then you just get media portrayed as an asshole.
It's a tough
totally,
one.
Yeah, and then your whole kind of, I guess, a lot of like the success is built on the fans like going and watching your movies and supporting you. So then it's sort of perceived as a small ask. Would you mind standing for a photo with me there? And if you continue to say no, do you become? It's a difficult line to thread, really.
Yeah, and there's a perception that if you ask for a selfie, that might only be 5 seconds of your life. But if they're asked for 100 selfies on the way going in, that's 500 seconds, which is nearly 10 minutes, and they do that at everything they go to. Then, like, it's a big chunk out of your life. So you can understand why they'd be like, look, I just don't have the time, I don't have the energy, or I don't have it in me to feign, you know, politeness for 15 minutes here. But then you become you get this public rep for being unlikable.
Obviously, outside of the work environment, is there anyone you met that was really famous when you were like a kid or like a teenager that you got a selfie or like an autograph with? Well, selfies didn't exist when we were teenagers, did they? I don't know.
I have been in the Oval Office 4 times, and I have put questions to presidents of the United States. I've sat down with Taoiseig. I've been in Downing Street, and I've asked questions of a prime minister. I was in the company of Eric Cantona and I became a total juvenile, blubbering, incoherent mess.
That's nice.
I literally had no idea what to say to the man. I think I asked him, like, so are you staying in... He was at a meet and greet thing in Dublin and he had one the following night in Belfast. And I was like, are you staying in Dublin tonight? Are you going to Belfast? And he was like, no, I stay. And I went, cool.
Have a good night then, Mr. Cantona.
What a man. Like, reduced to nothingness by just his majesty.
That. Yeah, that's brilliant. How about you?
I can't really think.
I don't mean either. I'm struggling
really
here.
I don't think so.
I've expected you to answer it and I can't even think of one myself.
Yeah, no, I can't really think of anyone, to be honest, Sarah, on that. But I think there's a general point on this though now, like that it's just gone to that point that social media has driven this economy almost around selfies and stuff, that it must feel fairly crap and fairly lonely for a lot of people who are going out there, can't even just go down to the supermarket or whatever without fear of like, I'm going to have to stop to do this, that and the other, and this person's going to quote me and I don't have any control over what they're going to do and what they're going to ask and all that sort of stuff. That is tough. But there isn't that level of privacy there that I think that probably existed even a few years ago before the selfie culture really ratcheted up to where it is.
Yeah. I met Proof from D12 once. Do you know D12, Eminem's band?
Oh yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. I met him in the Four Seasons in Dublin. I mean, like, no,
Was it at a meet and greet or like, did you know where the band was staying?
No, I was actually going to a Westlife concert that night. And Eminem was playing in Ireland the same night. I think he was playing in Leopardstown and Westlife was on their big summer run at the time. My friend Susie and I, we met Keane from Westlife and then Proof from D12 was out in the reception of the hotel and my friend Holly was a big Eminem fan, so I asked him to sign an autograph for me and I told him that my name was Holly for my friend Holly, and it was really sweet, and then he wrote to Holly, stay sweet, and it was lovely. Such a random story.
An unusual swerve at the end. But
what was their favourite famous song? Purple Hills, was it?
D12, there was My Band.
Was a great song. Yeah.
They were never really my thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
I wish for you an Eric Cantona moment at some point in the future where you're so overwhelmed by someone being so awesome.
I'm going to be honest. I actually don't think I'd have any of that reaction anymore, just because of that virtue of the fact that I feel like these people are so set upon and like, you know, mauled by people that I'm just like, I don't want to be that to them, do you know?
Yeah,
I just feel like it's probably gone just that.
I know, but I understand what Gav is saying about
100%.
I think, yeah.
I wouldn't begrudge you that moment, Gav, because I think that is a beautiful thing. To meet your childhood sporting hero is a beautiful thing.
Well, I think, like, even we had Alex Crawford on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and, like, I love her. Like, I legit love her. Nice. Oh, look at
that. I found my Cantona picture.
That's
yes.
Yes. Okay,
I brought a jersey from the 92-93 season, the iconic United one with the lacing on the collar, and I got him to sign it, and it's held up as if he's announced that he's a new signature.
Gav, you look so excited here.
I look so excited, and Eric Cantona, who has not even bothered to wear a shirt, he's just wearing a zippy with nothing on underneath, is so nonplussed by my clearly poor conversational skills
that
I was unable to engage the man for 15 seconds.
That is gorgeous. That is gorgeous. Okay, I think we're out of time.
I think so.
Great week. Enjoy the chats.
Yeah.
I'm kind of loving this, like, you know, we're enjoying this.
Well,
we hope we'll
be back on TV soon. But
we will be,
it's a very rootsy group chat is what it is. Very back to the roots.
It
like,
is.
You know?
Thanks to everyone who sent lovely messages during the week, actually, and they enjoyed last week's episode. We enjoyed making it too.
The people have spoken.
They have spoken. We're going to the Gossies. You're still going to that stag party.
Yep.
Yeah.
If it's not too late to vote, still vote for us in the Gossies,
I think
please
it
do.
Might be, actually.
Well,
it is definitely too late, actually.
not the point. If there are any Russians listening, please manipulate the election so that we win the Gossies.
Have you figured out what you're going to wear for the circus theme?
No. Okay. I have not. We'll figure it out. Be fine.
Stand by, everyone. It's going to be so exciting.
Good luck, guys. hope we win. If you don't come back with that award, I won't speak to you next week.
I'm telling you, we're not winning that. The category is unreal. We're not winning it, but we're going to represent. And we'll do you proud, hon. We'll do you proud.
Good stuff. That's all I ask.
Okay, thanks for listening, guys. We'll catch you again next week.
Bye.
Bye.
See you then.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. and they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.